Shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral. The Sphinx.
Can't you buy our whole dress?
Coral. The Sphinx.
Great gowns.
Coral.
Beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Coral.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another episode of the Every Outfit Podcast. We are 1 week away from going on tour, Chelsea.
Please come see us. We've been working on the show. I think it's really fun, but we'll see. Maybe it isn't. No, it definitely is. If you like the pod, you'll like the show.
I have to agree, as someone who's performed this with Chelsea. That's right, guys. We are rehearsing this for you guys. So we will be in Boston next week. The tour starts next Thursday, April 18th. Then we will be in New York. There are some tickets left for the late show. Then we will be in DC, Philly, Pittsburgh. Go into our episode description and we will link to where to get the tickets. Please come and see us. But if you are on the West Coast, I don't know if you know this, we just added more dates. San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, LA is upcoming. Again, go to everyoutfitinc.com/tour or just scroll down in whatever you're listening to. And in the episode description, we'll have links to all of these shows.
Beautiful. Okay, now that we've gotten that out of the way, we survived an eclipse this week, Lauren. How was the eclipse for you?
I wasn't aware that we were all caring about the eclipse until it was almost too late.
I mean, I don't care about the eclipse, so... I care about it in the sense that, like, sometimes if I'm in a bad, like, mental state, like, an eclipse is, like, not the thing that I need. But this one didn't really fuck me up. So, no complaints.
Oh, so you're talking about how it affected you. I was just talking about, like, here in Los Angeles, because we're not in the totality, I didn't think we all had to stop what we were doing and buy special glasses and look up at the sky at a certain time of day until it was almost too late, until my trainer's boyfriend rolled up from a 7-Eleven and had those glasses. And I was like, oh, are we doing this?
See, I'm glad I was in West Hollywood for the eclipse because it was fun seeing people like standing on the side of Sunset Boulevard, like staring up at the sun. It felt like a little bit historic. I love whenever there's a communal experience like that. I just was not part of it. I feel like I like eclipses better like in films than I do in real life.
Well, I'm also relieved that you said this because I experienced the eclipse by watching the NBC coverage where they were with people who were experiencing it in the totality, and you just saw it go from bright to dark, and it's like, I get religion now.
But see, it didn't even get fully dark here, so it was like a real who cares situation.
That's where I'm coming from. In LA and New York, we're not getting a totality eclipse, so... let's move on with our days.
I know. I thought it was going to be one of those eclipses. Like, have you ever seen Dolores Claiborne? Like, the other Kathy Bates, Stephen King movie?
No.
She, like, murders her abusive husband during a solar eclipse. Very dramatic. I think she throws him down a well. Spoiler alert for a movie that's 20 years old.
God damn it, Chelsea.
Yeah, it's very good. And Jennifer Jason Leigh plays her daughter.
That's good casting.
Well, also, speaking of eclipses, have you seen Watcher in the Woods?
No.
Okay, this is another iconic eclipse film starring old Betty Davis and young Kyle Richards.
Oh.
It was like one of those live action Disney movies for children that was actually like extremely traumatic.
Well, if that's the case and Kyle Richards was in it, then I've definitely seen a clip of it on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills at some point in my decade of watching that show.
I'm sure.
Chelsea, more importantly, even though the eclipse did not affect us in ways it affected other people, something that has really taken over our lives is this AI-generated diarrhea scenario that keeps...
Okay, stop. I can't believe you want to talk about that.
Chelsea's wife, Tatiana, and I share an obsession, an addiction really, to TikTok. And on the same day this week, this account that creates different AI-generated scenarios where it's like, you're about to have diarrhea, where would you like to go? It's like a toilet on a little like dinghy and a boat is about to crash into you. A terrifying bathroom in a forest and a bear is in the doorway. And it really has taken over our lives and we can't stop sending it in our group chats and asking what's the best scenario.
Well, it's funny because we always pick different ones and then we argue over like why someone else has picked the wrong scenario. There was a great one where there was just like a toilet, like basically in front of an entire wedding. I was like, oh, great preview of Lauren and Paul's wedding.
I was like, wouldn't this be the person who's marrying us at the altar who would be on the toilet? And you were like, in your mind, you were like, no, all three of us. So in this scenario, it's you, Paul, and I that are having explosive diarrhea on this altar toilet.
Oh, I wasn't bringing Paul into this because he's not on the group chat. I was saying Tad.
Oh, okay. So at my wedding, in this bizarro scenario where there's a toilet at the altar, Tad, you and I are all having explosive diarrhea. Half our audience has turned this episode off.
Worst thing to talk about ever, but I do find them to be extremely funny, and it's like maybe the best use of AI I've ever seen.
It's really its only purpose. I now feel less scary about the future. If this is what AI can give us, which is just to make us cry laugh multiple times a day, I'm here for it.
Yeah.
But I'd love to talk about when I left you last time we recorded, you were on your way to JoJo Siwa's release party, Chelsea. How was that?
Okay, so the party was in West Hollywood at a club, and it was celebrating the release of her single Karma as well as the debut of the music video for Karma.
Oh, wow.
Obviously, as someone that has been following JoJo Siwa quite closely in recent years and months.
Okay.
I guess we never talk about it on the pod just because it's kind of like a lesbian TikTok thing, but I feel like her recent rebrand and pivot into a bad girl era has caught the attention of quite a lot of people.
Yeah, I previously did not have opinion about JoJo Siwa, and now I do.
Well, it's kind of hard not to, but it was a very fun party, I have to say. I mean, it was definitely like rock bottom West Hollywood club vibes, but that's just the vibe of the entire neighborhood. But like all of her costumes from the Karma music video were on display. There was makeup artists giving JoJo Siwa like glam rock makeovers. And I actually like fucked up by not getting one, I'm now realizing.
So anything else interesting happened at this party?
Well, she played a few songs on the album, which honestly, not bad. No notes. But the craziest part was when she decided to rap Real Slim Shady in its entirety on stage. Like that was the only time she actually sang, and she did the whole song.
The side of TikTok I'm on that I experienced JoJo Siwa previous to this week was the fact that she's friends with James Charles, I believe. And my memory of James Charles at his height is at meet and greets, he would do a similar thing and just make all of his fans watch him while he sang an a cappella version of a, you know, Katy Perry's Roar.
Yeah. But honestly, I'm glad I was there to witness it. It felt like a very important moment in culture in a weird way. And it's funny to see something play out in a physical space that you've been watching online for so many weeks.
And also that sort of kicked off the last week of discourse, which has been about the release of this music video, the release of the single, JoJo's press around this. So where do we want to begin?
Should we talk about the look or the song first? I can't really decide.
I mean, it's all intertwined.
Look is overshadowing the song, I think.
The song in and of itself has its issues. We can get into that in a second. But when it comes to the look is particularly distracting for the type of music she's making.
No, absolutely. And for those of you who haven't seen this, she has pivoted from a sort of femmy, glittery child entertainer vibe to a demented West Hollywood glam rock Adam Lambert with fetal alcohol syndrome kind of vibe.
Yeah, I think anyone who is millennial and above, when they saw her at the iHeart Awards looking like she did, everyone went, oh, she's inspired by Kiss. But she did an interview, was like, I have no idea who Gene Simmons or what Kiss is.
Which is really wild. Not only is it Kiss, it's more specifically the designer Larry Legaspi, who is really underrated and genius. And actually, Rick Owens edited a really great Rizzoli book that came out a few years ago. But yes, to not understand the Gene Simmons of it all is quite cray.
Or maybe she's saying this because it is inspired by Kiss, but he's quite litigious and she's like, he might sue me if I acknowledge that I'm inspired by.
She acknowledged in some video clip I've seen circulating that she was inspired by Elton John and David Bowie and those kinds of artists. Her look is, of course, much more Kiss.
It just has the energy of one of those sheltered girls in your high school saying a bad word finally, but that bad word is heck.
Right, and I think a big part of the backlash is because it doesn't feel authentic to her. Like, she doesn't have enough life experience to go this hard at this particular time. But I think more the problem is in the execution of it. The problem is that her mom still makes her costumes.
Oh.
So it all feels very Etsy. You know, it, on one level, it's cool and wholesome that she's loyal to her mom in that way. But also, it's like the rest of the glam is fucked too. The hair, the makeup. I'm sure she's loyal to the same team that she's had since she was five or whatever the fuck she became famous. So I think a lot of the problems is just like in the creative and the execution of it.
I've seen a take where people believe that JoJo actually concocted this cringe persona to distract from an unflattering Rolling Stone article that came out in February about a pop group that she and her mother manage called XOMG Pop! Exclamation point. And I don't believe that this woman is that calculated.
Not to say that I think this gothic glam rock look is authentic to her, but I think that she does come from a very authentic place. I don't think that she's a contrived person necessarily.
Also, it is her age, and I feel like such an elder in saying that, but you are watching someone sort of act out in a very genuine, but it's cringe.
It's cringe, but honestly, the more TikToks I watch of her, the more I'm like, I actually kind of like her. And my hot take is that Karma is a good song.
Of course Karma is a good song.
Let's just play a clip of it here for those of you who haven't experienced this absolute bop. That's on our lie. That's on our tea.
My minor gripe with the chorus of Karma is that I just kept thinking every time the chorus happened that it was going to be a play on the line from Batman Returns where Catwoman's like, life's a bitch, now so am I.
Okay, you would have that thought.
It's a Scrap Miley song. The other mini controversy about this is JoJo Siwa, in describing this song, kind of made it seem like she wrote it. Even though she didn't, I went back and saw the clip. She didn't literally say that. She was just talking about, oh, a year ago, I didn't feel like I could say these types of things.
Right.
And people took it to mean that she wrote Karma, but she didn't. It's a Scrap Miley Cyrus song from 2011 that was written by a woman named Britt Smith, which people have found the music video that Britt Smith did for this song from a decade ago, which makes a lot of sense. It is a pop song that feels like it's from the 2010s.
And the music video is truly so bonkers, guys. If you haven't seen it, like, fire it up right now. She's in this crazy Kiss outfit, but she's doing like choreo, like, on a beach.
Yeah, it has like a mermaid slash below deck aesthetic.
Well, and I like that about it. Like, I think that starting the video on a lesbian cruise, which is what this looks like, is funny. Like, that is like part of lesbian culture and a fun thing to parody. And then of course she falls off the boat and ends up on a desert island and shit gets crazy, guys.
Here's the tough thing about camp is everything that's going on with JoJo Siwa's current persona and the music video, the song, the whole thing is that it is high camp. But a thing about camp is that people are being very genuine.
That's why this is the campiest thing that's happened in ages, and that's why I went to the party.
But it's not intentional. I don't think she's doing a satire of anything.
Whatever, it works.
Did you get to the part in Call Her Daddy? I saw this clip where JoJo Siwa asks Alex Cooper how old she is, and Alex Cooper goes 29, and she just goes, yeah, that's usually the age of the person that has a problem with me.
Yes, I did get to that
part. Was like, that is brutal.
I know. Also, respect to Alex Cooper for conducting what I think is a quite good interview. It's very impressive to me that she is such a good interviewer, given her lack of a journalism background, I suppose.
The call her daddy pivot, I think, has been brilliant of like, what if I was just a millennial Charlie Rose for women know. That buy aloe and do Legree Pilates?
What if I was Jenny McCarthy and Charlie Rose in a single person? It's so smart. I hope we get a good live performance of Karma soon. That's what I want to see.
Yeah, I have to hand it to her. I mean, there is a part of me that's like, wow, I wish that I was a little less self-aware and had a little bit of this delusion that JoJo Siwa has.
No, everyone should. Like, it's not cool being like jaded and overly self-conscious.
And honestly, the joke's on us because the video has been out for less than a week and it already has 16 million views the last time I checked.
Although I guess we should mention the other thing that she's getting dragged for, which is saying that she's starting a new genre of music that's called gay pop.
Yes. Thoughts, Chelsea?
Well, it's weird because as established, she does know that Elton John exists.
Well, I think she just thought that it hadn't existed since then.
This George Michael erasure. But I just love the confidence in thinking that you're creating a new genre of music in 2024.
I think the best tweet I saw was the person who was like, this is very hard for me to see JoJo Siwa and not think this was John Early.
That's brilliant, truly.
Summer is fast approaching, which means more social events, more weddings to attend, or in my case, throw, more nights out on the town, and hopefully, more vacations. That's why I'm so thankful for today's sponsor, Honeylove, for covering us with the best shapewear. You've heard me swear up and down about their Superpower Short. I can't live without it now. See, the Superpower Short smooth, shapes, and lifts, giving you a flawless silhouette under any outfit. Might I be wearing this underneath my own wedding dress? I think so. It has targeted compression technology that distinguishes between areas where you want more support and areas that you need less compression. And their Signature X targets and sculpts your midsection without squeezing your natural curves. It's designed to work with your body, not against it. Imagine that. With Honeylove, you can feel your best even when you're wearing less. They've revolutionized compression technology, so you no longer have to feel like you're suffocating while wearing effective shapewear. Honeylove shapewear features lingerie-inspired design details that you'll want to show off and is made with breathable fabric that keeps you nice and cool, which is perfect for hot days. For a limited time, only you, dear fuckette, can get Honeylove on sale. Get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link, honeylove.com/outfit. Support our show and check them out at honeylove.com/outfit.
Anyway, on to some bad news.
Bad news!
Only on every outfit.
Just week after week, Chelsea, we're forced to keep adding bad news segments. I don't want to keep doing bad news segments, but here we are.
Okay, so where should we start? J-Lo's bots?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of people who have a level of delusion, I would like a little bit of... Jennifer Lopez has been getting an onslaught of online hate. Became very clear that her team hired bots to leave nice comments on Jennifer Lopez videos as everyone kept writing, you know, love Jennifer Garner. And like, is that from the block?
Turn off your comments. I don't understand. Taylor Swift has her comments turned off. Like, if you're at the point where you're considering hiring bots, you should just shut the comments off. It's not like she needs like engagement. So basically, this was brought to our attention by some TikTok creator who found multiple comments on a single Jennifer Lopez post that were from the perspective of a waiter who had waited on J-Lo at a restaurant and given her a salad.
That's right. And you know what's worse than having your comments turned off, Chelsea? Having badly written AI chatbots leaving comments talking about how regal she looked and how it was an honor to serve her a salad.
This is so depressing because Jennifer Lopez, like, I'm sorry, I know she's gotten a lot of hate lately, but like, she shouldn't have to resort to this kind of shit.
But I wonder how much of this at that level of celebrity is actually getting to her. And how much of it is her team just doing damage control?
Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
So, Chelsea, our elder cinema fathers are in trouble. As you know, Chel, we talked about a few episodes ago how we were thrilled to learn that John Waters would be making his return with a movie, with an adaptation of his book Liar Mouth, starring Aubrey Plaza. However, during a recent Academy Museum screening, he clarified that they don't actually have the funding yet to make Liar Mouth, and they might not.
It's so weird to me that this is a news item now, as that screening at the Academy Museum was literally like months ago. That was like when the exhibit came out. And it kind of baffles me because it's like, how much can a John Waters movie shot in Baltimore starring Aubrey Plaza cost?
Since A Dirty Shame, which was 2004, which is before the remake of Hairspray that did very well, that he has been commissioned to write six other films, including not one, not two, but four Hairspray sequels that never got made.
So he's getting that check at the very least.
Yes, but he's unable to get it over the finish line, and anyone that has worked in the film industry knows that getting financing, especially independent film financing, is especially difficult. But I thought that's why all these billionaires started financing companies. Financing a John Waters film for $15 or $20 million, like, that is like having a Picasso on the wall.
I guess just the wrong kind of people have money. But I don't get it, because I feel like this movie, which would be about a woman who steals luggage from the airport, this seems like the kind of thing that you could just give a limited theatrical release to, dump it on Hulu, and people would just watch it that don't know who the fuck John Waters is.
I would agree with you. I mean, the economics are very different. I mean, the real reason why our cinema elders aren't making as many films is just the loss of the DVD market, right? It used to be that films that had a mid-sized budget, yes, maybe didn't perform or make their money back in the theater, but through rentals and then licensing on TV, it would make its money back. It would find a following. Famously, Shawshank Redemption did terribly in theaters. And because it did so terribly, it was so cheap to license. That's why it was on TNT all the time. It found a following. It's like number four on IMDb's top 100 films. But people are scared. David Lynch revealed that Netflix wouldn't greenlight his animated feature Snoot World, and that he's struggled to find financing for this project that he has been working on for 20 years with Edward Scissorhands and Addams Family writer Caroline Thompson. Sounds like a no-brainer to me.
Okay, but also that could be completely crazy. Like, David Lynch is very, like, makes movies with a lot of mass appeal and then makes ones that are, like, completely insane that, like, only a handful of people will be into, like Inland Empire or something.
That was sort of the idea of a Netflix, of an Apple TV, was that they were gonna make the things that studios weren't making anymore. But it's like Netflix too wants to make $200 million movies with The Rock and Chris Evans. It's just about balance. And then finally, Francis Ford Coppola, who self-financed his passion project, Megalopolis.
That doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. Maybe that's why he can't get this movie made.
I know. He self-financed, this is a dream project of his, to the tune of $120 million, Chelsea. He financed this film by selling off part of his vineyard, part of the wine company. And he now can't find anyone to release the film. So he recently hosted a screening for Universal, Netflix, whatever. No one has agreed to take on the movie, probably because, according to Francis Ford Coppola, he believes that it will need $100 million to cover the movie's marketing and distribution, and studios are unwilling to pay that for such an experimental and what is called a bizarre movie.
But we still don't really have a firm read on, like, is it good or not?
It will be debuting at Cannes. It is the film opening up the film festival, so we'll be getting reviews soon. But it is about the dueling visions of an idealistic architect played by Adam Driver and a pragmatic mayor played by Giancarlo Esposito as they rebuild a city after its destruction, which is reportedly inspired by ancient Rome. Who wouldn't like that film, Chelsea?
It's more like male director Roman Empire shit.
These men, they're always thinking about the Roman Empire.
Truly. Well, one thing that traumatized me this week was that clip that you sent me of the Amy Winehouse movie Back in Black.
Yeah, per our conversation, like, John Waters can't get money for his movie, but yet we're making a biopic about Amy Winehouse, which I want to apologize because previously when we talked about this film, I was like, guys, if they're making a film about Amy Winehouse, her estate, her family signed off on this. And then I just saw an interview with Sam Taylor Wood where she was like, actually the family did not have any involvement in this film. And I'm like, okay, well.
And we, you know, respect her. That's, I think, why I really wasn't expecting to see what I saw.
We should probably play this clip here. It is in part the actions, but also the voice performance.
Thought you had so many lessons to learn. I say you don't know what love is. Get a grip.
So the film comes out next month, which is astounding to me that this film, which I feel like I've seen no press for, is coming out before Wicked, which I've seen all of the press for. It's sitting at 55% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's not looking good. This review from IndieWire says, everyone involved in the film approaches the late artist with love and respect, but its tawdry instincts and misguided sense of responsibility let her memory down.
It just sucks because, like, Amy Winehouse is such a fascinating person and in theory should be the perfect subject for a film. So it's like, I feel like the casting of this chick was not right.
I don't know if there's any way to do a biopic justice. I mean, I also feel this way about the Timothée Chalamet Bob Dylan film.
Moving on to some good news.
Sure.
Rihanna is on the cover of Interview magazine with a very glamorous nunsploitation makeover. And this was a truly seismic event on the corner of the internet that I happen to inhabit. Like, I woke up and my entire Instagram feed was this.
So it was shot by Nadia Lee Cohen, and the interview is done by her former stylist, friend of the show, Mel Ottenberg, and it's incredible.
I think the combination of Nadia and Mel is so major because when you think about their most popular covers, let's say, for the past couple years, it has been the Lana Del Rey one, the Kim Kardashian one, and this one.
It is
so very productive partnership. It's just so rare that any magazine cover gets this amount of attention in 2024.
That is true. It got so much attention that we didn't even notice that Zendaya is on not one but two Vogue covers that dropped this week.
I know. I didn't even find out about it until like that night. It like completely was buried somehow. That really goes to show that it's just like in fashion, you gotta take a risk. Vogue does the same shit day in and day out, and they have way more resources than Interview does. Yet Interview actually made the cover that like people are talking about.
But I think why this cover resonates, or people who are looking at this cover are like, why is this so good? It's because it's a bunch of friends working together. And I'm sorry, but you can see that. Like, it just comes out.
Yeah, it's good creative. And it's also transforming a celebrity. So you see another side of the celebrity, which Vogue never does.
I was particularly interested in this interview because Mel gets Rihanna to talk about The Real Housewives, which I would love to discuss her quote about Kyle Richards and Morgan Wade. It has to be so weird to have celebrities interested in other celebrities' lives. It's like when Jennifer Lawrence talks about the Housewives, but she says of Kyle Richards and Morgan Wade, I just feel like she was able to reobserve her marriage through the new lens. For one, someone else made her feel valued, made her feel like she was cute and quirky and fun and all the great things that maybe were taken for granted before. And that's why I believe that there's something with Morgan, because sometimes it takes that for you to fight for what you deserve. And yet, we still have not gotten this on the show.
Well, also, do you believe that they're a couple? I haven't been paying close enough attention, but some of my lesbian friends are like, I don't think so, after seeing the show. So
after seeing the show, it's tough. I would like Kyle to have a late in life lesbian turn, just because if she doesn't have romantic feelings for Morgan and it's not being reciprocated, then it's this even sadder thing of just a platonic obsession with a lesbian.
Right.
I want something better for Kyle is what I'm trying to say.
Watch her in the woods too.
I do like how the interview starts with Rihanna and Mel talking about how there's not enough open necks on the runway or in stores.
Which is something I've truly never thought about.
But they are correct.
I just will always love a slutty nun. To me, that is just like evergreen fashion imagery. And it's been a really long time since we've gotten a nun fashion shoot in a magazine. Like, I feel like the last one was that Kate Moss one from W, where she was in like a latex habit. A habit in general is just incredible and has been an ongoing source of inspiration for fashion designers. Like, I feel like we've gotten Dolce and Margiela nuns pretty recently. But I love whenever we get a nun on the catwalk.
That's true. Although nunsploitation really, it is its own exploitive film subgenre.
And I actually haven't seen that many of them because, I mean, most of them are bad. Although I do love Behind Convent Walls, which is, I think, from the 70s. Very bizarre, creepy, horny nun movie.
It's not a good movie. I did watch it recently, but it has some of the best poster art ever.
Yeah.
And it's making me realize I need the Behind Convent Walls poster for my new house.
They were not good, but visually they're amazing. And they always have, you know, some sort of lesbian something.
Right. I mean, I think the origin of nunsploitation comes from the film Black Narcissus.
Although that wasn't like erotic necessarily. I mean, it was kind of like maybe that was like implied in a way that like erotic tensions were simmering beneath the surface or whatever. That's just a movie about nuns in the Himalayas that like just go crazy.
FX, I realized, did a series version of Black Narcissus last year, but I didn't see it and I don't think it's good.
I didn't see it. Did anyone watch it? I mean, it's insane that that movie exists. It's insane that it's from the 40s because it just looks so nuts. It looks like a Nadia Lee Cohen photo shoot from today.
I mean, not technically nunsploitation, but I also think of Ken Russell's The Devils, which is more just artistic religious perversion.
I've never seen that.
It's pretty major. There's also Benedetta, which we still have not seen.
That's crazy because that's one of those movies where I was so excited about it. And then it's like a certain amount of time went past and I didn't see it. And now I feel like I can't see it.
Nuns also go into different genres of film. There's, of course, Sister Act.
My favorite movie, Sister Act.
I also think about The Little Hours, which is one of my favorite movies from the last 10 years.
If you haven't seen that, Aubrey Plaza and Alison Brie, shout out to our celebrity fuckhead Alison Brie, play medieval nuns, except for they talk like you and I.
I didn't know a movie could be like that because it does look so major. They are in period costumes, but they are talking in a contemporary way that makes it very enthralling. But we are in a new nunsploitation moment because Sydney Sweeney's film Immaculate came out a few weeks ago, which I did see.
How was it? Was it not immaculate?
No. That sigh was like, I'm trying to think of a non-spoilery review of it, but I loved it. It was a good little nunsploitation film. And I think that Sydney Sweeney is an astounding producer. Like, this is a movie she auditioned for 10 years ago, didn't get, never got made. When she got a little bit of juice, she optioned it, got the director who directed her in a previous film to direct this. Neon's marketing campaign for this has been brilliant. On April 3rd, I believe it was, last week, they did $6.66 screenings.
Very cute.
Also, what was released recently was The First Omen, which is supposed to be another nunsploitation film.
What's more timeless than a nun? Like, a nun is major in every era, in every time period. Speaking of other things that we loved, the Maxine trailer came out this week.
Oh my goodness gracious.
Inject this into my veins, please.
Yeah, I mean, the trailer for our new favorite movie came out.
I will be there opening day. I love this whole trilogy. I love Mia Goth. I love the Los Angeles of it all. Was not expecting the Night Stalker to come into this because obviously both X and Pearl were not rooted in historical events.
Yeah, I too was not expecting that this is where the movie was going to go. So Maxine is an adult actress who's going to become a screen queen.
By an adult actress, you mean a porn star.
Yes. And she's been cast in a horror film and she hopes that this is going to be her launching pad to be a real dramatic actress, which I was like, wow, really? Sydney Prescott's mom in Scream 3 storyline we have going on here. Including the like walking through a film studio backlot being haunted by a killer as well. I was also taken by surprise when Maxine walks
by the psycho house.
Yes. I'm so interested of how this film is going to play out because there is a serial killer stalking the streets of Los Angeles and it's the Night Stalker, who really existed at that time, but obviously there's a separate killer who is killing people involved in Maxine's life.
And we got a little glimpse of Bobby Cannavale in the trailer. We got some Kevin Bacon, our boys.
Bobby Cannavale, I just know him as the man with the funkiest tasting spunk.
This poor man, despite his numerous accomplishments, that's just all he'll ever be.
I do love the actress Elizabeth Debicki, who's featured in the film as a producer or a director, but she seems to just be playing Greta Gerwig in this film.
So when is that actually coming out?
July 5th, 2024. Also, I thought the A24 is the Hollywood sign at the beginning of the trailer was so good.
Truly, no notes. Did you watch Palm Royale?
I watched a few episodes as requested.
Okay, what do you think?
My non-spoiler review is, do you ever wish that the talented Mr. Ripley had lower stakes and like and look like if Jacques Demy made a 1960s Doris Day film? Because this is the TV show for you.
Truly. I personally am enjoying watching it. I love a mid-century Palm Beach aesthetic more than anything, really. And the cast is obviously fantastic, but I have one major gripe, which is that I think that Kristen Wiig is miscast. This is a role for Goldie Hawn or Reese Witherspoon. Like, there's a reason why we don't cast, like, a Carol Burnett in a Goldie Hawn role. Like, she, I don't know, I think Kristen Wiig, I think she's a comedic genius, but I think a character like this requires a level of ditziness that she can't just summon naturally.
Yeah, the thing that I'm having the hardest time reconciling is I keep thinking this is going to be a satire or a parody. It's not. It's a straight up low stakes kind of grifter story.
Except for I find it really hard to sympathize with Kristen Wiig's character also, because her main ambition is just to become the queen bee in a group of rich Palm Beach society women.
Yeah, for those who have not seen the show, it's set in the 1960s. It's on Apple TV. Kristen Wiig plays a woman that not only wants to be a part of Palm Beach high society, but very specifically a tennis and pool club.
Yeah, like if this was the 80s, Shelley Long would play this role.
Does a mystery start happening? Because the first two episodes are just kind of world building and...
Yes, mysteries happen.
But from the jump, it's like Kristen Wiig desperately wants to be a part of this club. In episode one, it's Leslie Bibb. And then in the second episode, it's more Allison Janney trying to keep her from joining. It's very similar beats is my issue thus far with the show.
For sure. But I do love Allison Janney. And Carol Burnett. The cast is completely genius.
My favorite part thus far is Kaia Gerber, who sort of played the Jennifer Coolidge and Legally Blonde of this world. She's a nail technician who's meant for more, baby.
Yeah.
Whose unseen boyfriend is just keeping her down.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that she's on this show too.
Also, we haven't mentioned the fact that Laura Dern is in this show wearing an insane wig.
It's like this strawberry blonde, long bangs, like sort of blunt wig, which feels really random because she's the one character on the show that is playing just like a very like by the book second wave feminist who like has like is hosting consciousness raising meetings, and it actually just would make sense to have her actual hair.
I guess I keep watching these episodes thinking something else is going to be revealed just because the look is so campy. Kristen Wiig's in it. That's why I keep thinking it's going to turn into a parody or satire. And Laura Dern is wearing such an insane wig that I keep being like, there must be a reveal about why she's wearing this wig. But I think it's just a character choice.
No. It's a very bizarre hair choice. But I am astounded at how much money this show must cost to make. And you haven't even gotten into the episodes that are like extremely elaborate in terms of like set design and stuff. Like, it's pretty crazy.
Apple would not greenlight Sofia Coppola's TV series, but they greenlit this.
I'm watching it. I'm glad they have some programming for women.
I also watched a few episodes of Apple's Never Fall, which I know you're watching as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, this show is perfect for me right now because I need something that I can just like watch, not have to pay super close attention to, but still understand, you know? I need some cliffhangers, some intrigue, some toxic family dynamics. But like, this series was based on a book, but like, you would swear it was based on streaming data. because it's very much like, did you like the crime aspect of The Staircase, but the sort of fucked up family dynamics of White Lotus and the sort of like casual bouginess of Big Little Lies?
Well, it's crazy because the book is from the author who wrote Big Little Lies and Nine Perfect Strangers. The thing that I couldn't believe toggling between Palm Royale and Apples Never Fall is they both
set in Palm Beach.
Yes, they both take place in Palm Beach.
I know. I know. It's so random.
So for those who are unfamiliar with Apples Never Fall, it is about the Delaney family who have a long-running tennis academy. Their four children, patriarch played by Sam Neill, the matriarch played by Annette Bening, their four adult children played by Jake Lacy of White Lotus and Girls Fame. Again, our favorite fuckette, Allison Brie, two other people, I'm sorry, I do not know their names, and their mom goes missing. It's every millennial's worst fear, which is your mom goes missing and you're asked what their birthday is and you don't remember.
Okay, but I know what year my mom was born in. Do you?
Of course. Okay. I actually do know my parents' birthday, but I always love when media portrays someone actually going missing and it's like, oh, wait, what information do I know? I feel like we talked about this recently. Like, I don't have your phone number memorized. I don't have Paul's phone number memorized. But I'm only a couple of episodes into that. I love that you're like, oh, it's a show I can just have on in the background. Because I feel like I have to pay attention. Because the first two episodes, things are going back and forth. You're seeing flashbacks and what's going on presently, which is their mother is missing, while also seeing a bunch of backstory. And I'm like, wait, hold on. Because the dad's like, she's not missing. And I'm like, she's not missing. We just saw her in the previous scene. But it's like, oh, wait, that's a flashback.
Babes, if Annette Bening is in the scene, it's a flashback. Okay. It's a very realistic family. Like, I actually do believe that this random group of actors have known each other for years, which is impressive, I think.
Yeah. I always think of, what was that movie that came out with Jane Fonda 8 or 10 years ago called This Is Where I Leave You, where we have to believe that, like, Corey Stahl, Tina Fey, Adam Driver are all related to each other, and it's like, no fucking way.
We have some mailbag questions.
Yeah, I think this might be a nice way to finish out the episode. We had so much fun last week with hotline questions.
So these were all submitted via Instagram, and I really love this one. Should I tell my friends that I'm in a throuple? It's been over 3 years. One friend knows and didn't take it well.
The friend you're telling that you're in a throuple, are they also in that throuple and are unaware of that until this moment?
I question who your friends are, because I feel like you should be able to tell your friends that you're in a throuple, especially after 3 years. Like, that's a long relationship.
Yeah, have they really not noticed in 3 years?
Like, I get, like, yeah, maybe don't tell your employer that you're in a throuple, but certainly your friends should be the people that you should be able to talk to about that.
Also, this is a question that leads me to have more questions, because the phrasing of one friend knows and did not take it well makes it seem like you did not tell them and maybe perhaps they walked in on the throuple happening and that's why they didn't take it well?
They didn't take it well because they're a judgy bitch, I would assume. If my friend was like, Chelsea, I'm in a throuple, I would be supportive and fascinated. I would never stop asking questions.
Also, what are you gaining / losing by not telling people? It has been 3 years.
Yeah, like, do you like the illicit secret aspect of being in a secret throuple? Because in that case, maybe just like keep it under wraps for the vibes.
Or are they introducing this third as a friend? And they've actually secretly been in the outer friend group for a while. But it's just being like, actually, this is a person I'm in a throuple with.
Well, also, it's like, we don't know. Do they all live together? Like, are they all sleeping in the same bed every single night? Or is there like a primary couple and then they have like a side piece that kind of like is a regular special guest? Anyway, moving on. Thoughts on Bodhi?
You know, if you've got $1,500 to spend on a...
You don't have to like it, Lauren.
Bodhi to me is like Kate, which is like, if you've got the money to spend $1,500 on a cardigan or like $600 on a Western themed shirt, go for it. It wouldn't be me.
I think it's like an unspoken rule in New York where there always has to be one hot upcycling designer in every single era.
Right.
Like when we lived in New York, it was like Imitation Nation of Christ and Susan Cianciolo. And now it's Bodhi, because their whole thing is like they're making clothes out of like old tablecloths and old quilts and just sheets and just insert discarded textile here. But I have noticed people dressing in this look, which I think it's rare that a small brand is able to sort of create such an easily identifiable look that you then just see, you know, become more and more popular.
I'll always have an issue with like expensive clothing that has a look of a handmade, almost childlike quality to them.
Okay, but handmade clothes like should be expensive. Like to be able to sustain a brand, especially if you're like them doing things on a very small scale, making pieces that are one of a kind, your pricing is gonna have to be kind of high to even make that possible.
There's obviously an audience for it. They can pay for it. Wouldn't be me.
And I wouldn't wear it either. It's not really my look. Although I do think that the crochet pieces are quite good. I like when I see people in that stuff, you know, out and about.
And I think their bags are really good as well.
Next question. Where are we going with all of these exposed nipples?
Straight to jail.
Okay, we're getting Ubers and walking straight into the club or the party, or we're wearing jackets on the street and then we're taking them off at the club. We're not just walking around with our tits out, are we? Well, I'm not.
No, and the applications where we've seen exposed nipples are on the runway, on Florence Pugh on the red carpet, or Bianca Censori.
I think it's becoming progressively more acceptable. Like, I'm now not fazed when I see someone's nipples.
Are you seeing nipples out there?
Absolutely. But again, it's like that's a after 11 p.m. kind of thing.
That's what I'm saying. By mainstream, I don't think people are going to dinner at 7 p.m. with their tits out. Do I think that the proliferation of this on the runway then gives Zara and other fast fashion brands license to be like, oh, now we need even less lining on shirts, and it's up to the consumer to wear an undershirt, a bra, or nothing underneath it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Chelsea, when we were thinking of questions to answer, I realized I have a question of my own that I would love your help on, which is, where are we getting underwear? Because I've come to a place where, like, I need to do a restock. Like, the hanky-panky thongs I have are hanging on by a thread.
Okay, well, hanky-panky thongs need to be replenished.
I understand that. I'm just saying, are we still getting hanky-panky thongs? I have some Skims. What are we doing?
I think a hanky-panky, that's an item of clothing that actually has, like, a practical use. Like, there's certain kind of clothes that, like, you can only wear with a hanky-panky. But yeah, I mean, I get all my underwear from Skims. I don't like to complicate things. I like Skims cotton underwear, whatever style. I have bikinis, I have thongs, I have high-waisted briefs. I love all of it. I think it's better to have fewer pairs of underwear, same is true of socks, and then just throw them away regularly. It's not good to have 20 pairs of underwear that are in various stages of decomposition.
Because I am at that place where I do need to wholesale replace most of the underwear I have.
I mean, Tom Ford is more extreme. I think he replaces all of his socks and underwear like every 2 weeks or something. Like, I don't even know if he washes his underwear, and that's obviously not correct. But don't find something and be like, oh, wow, I still have this. Anyway, what else do we have? If you had a hall pass to any minor Sex in the City actor, who are you choosing?
I think I would go with
Matthew McConaughey as himself.
Okay. That's you.
No, I wouldn't go with that. He was so annoying.
I would hook up with maybe season one Justin Theroux author, not to be confused with season two Justin Theroux Shortcomings author.
Interesting, because I think he was hotter in Shortcomings. Although, does he have the erectile dysfunction? Like, in this world, does he have this affliction? Or is it just, like, physically, who would you hook up with?
I'm assuming that he has his premature ejaculation affliction. But there's something about season one, Justin Theroux. I believe his character's name is Jared. Because his glasses and his hair is giving his character in Mulholland Drive, which I've always found very attractive. So There's that. I would also say perhaps Charlotte's boyfriend, who was the chef that she thought was gay.
Interesting choice. He's someone I never think about.
I think he would be a good boyfriend. And, you know, so what? He didn't like to see a mouse. I don't like to see a mouse either. I'd probably scream as well.
I'm picking Tamara Tooney as the power lesbian art collector. There's no other answer for me, really. If I look at the minor characters on Sex and the City.
And Maria was on the show too much to be considered a minor character.
I think she could be considered a minor character, but I'm a little alarmed by the ease in which she commits domestic violence, I suppose. I don't fuck with that.
Well, you also love your plates and flatware too much to risk it.
Yeah.
All right, guys, we have come to the end of the episode, and it was just as true at the top of the episode. We will be on tour next week. But do not worry, guys. We have a banger of a Sex and the City rewatch episode for you.
Yes, we're doing one of our most requested episodes, The Post-It Always Sticks Twice. You may have heard of her.
For those who are going to be in cities we won't be visiting next week, please watch that. And if you are in any of the cities we will be coming to, please check out the show. We work really hard on it. I don't want to threaten and say that we're never going to come to the cities again if they're not well attended, but
we might not. Yeah.
So come to our first and maybe final tour.
All right, guys. Bye.
All right. See you next week. Bye.